Hi, my name's June. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I really want to thank you for having me be part of your weekend. There really aren't that many people that I know here, at this conference, but the few that I do have been some of the most important people in my life. And when I got here, the only person I really, know from Sacramento is Whitey. And when I got here, I was really excited about a chance to see him. I didn't know he was going to be chairing the meeting. Because there were some, I don't remember what year it was exactly, but when Whitey and I became friends, we were both going through a very difficult time for both of us. And we spent some time together, and we learned to be friends. It's taken a long time for me, and a lot of different lessons for me to learn to be friends. I always wanted friends. I always wanted people to be my friends, but I never really was willing to give anything. A lot of that had to do with the fact that I didn't think I had anything to give. A lot of it, too, had to do with the fact that I've always had a mind, something like a computer or a calculator, actually. If you give me $5, then I want to give you $5. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, it has not been my experience that it works that way. Shauna may take me out to dinner, and 6 years from now, I may give Shauna a book that helps her life. It's entirely different. The book only cost 95 cents. She took me out for a lobster dinner that was $25. It doesn't seem like that should work. And yet it's been my experience that it does. Sometimes you go to a conference and you say a poem that I don't even know if I remember now. But Whitey remembers it, and it's helped his life. And someone had shared it with me, and it had helped mine. And it's really amazing to me how people work in our lives. And sometimes we don't even know it. And sometimes, most of the time, they don't even know it. I can't tell you how many people have changed my life without even realizing it. They're somewhere in Texas or Indiana or Hawaii or whatever. I don't even remember their name. But I remember the story. I remember the little story that they told, because I'm a very big story person. I when someone says, have you heard so-and-so talk? All I can tell you is if you tell me that there were two Dobermans that were chasing a poodle and it had something to do, then I can remember if I've heard their talk. And so for me, stories in Alcoholics Anonymous have been very, very important. I was thinking about one of them this morning. There's a woman named Julie C. In my neighborhood, and she tells this story about when she was fairly new. She was married, and she was married to a very traditional man who wanted his dinner on the table as soon as he came home. And she had, that particular night, she wanted to make sure that dinner was ready and on the table because she needed to get to the meeting afterwards. And she was standing there and she was waiting for the bus because she had to get the bus to get home to make the dinner so that she could get to the meeting. And she really needed to get to this meeting. And so all she was thinking of is, where's the bus? I've got to get to the meeting. I've got to get the bus. I've got to get home. I've got to make the dinner so we don't have a fight so I can get to the meeting. And I've got to get to the meeting. And she was very new. And she stood there and she started to wait and the bus didn't come. And she started to pray for the bus and the bus didn't come. And she started to cry and she thought, if the bus doesn't come, I'm going to have to drink. You know how that fits. And she was standing there and suddenly this woman in a Mercedes pulled up and rolled down her little electric window, and they had recognized each other from a meeting somewhere. And the woman said, where are you going? And Julie told her, and the woman said, oh, I'm going that way, and gave Julie a ride home. And Julie ended up realizing later that she had gotten home 10 minutes earlier than she would have gotten if she had gotten the bus that she had prayed for and it had been on time. And she later realized that she was spending a lot of time praying for buses when God was sending her Mercedes. I think about that story a lot in my life, and it's one of the things that's helped me not pray for specific things. It's helped me understand a little bit about what it says in the 11th step, praying only for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry it out. I sincerely believe today that God has better things in store for me than I have ever had for myself. And the reason that I believe that, one of the biggest reasons I believe that, is because today I live a life I never wanted any part of, and I'm a person I wouldn't have even liked when I came here, and I'm happier than I've ever been. And I was never a happy person. A lot of the things that when Shauna was talking about the fact that she didn't think she had been one of those people who lost her self-worth or her self-esteem, I am also one of those people. I don't remember ever having any. I grew up in an alcoholic home, and so I know as much about alcoholism as any of the rest of you did. There was a lot of violence in my home. There was a lot of broken promises. There was a lot of all those things. I never wanted that way of life. I wasn't going to be like that, I didn't think. And as I was a kid, I started to make a lot of judgments, and I started to form a lot of my old ideas that I have had to work through in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my old ideas, some of the earliest ones that I remember, was as I looked around at the men and the women in my life, almost all of whom I know today were alcoholics, as I looked at these people, I saw that the men and women handled the exact same situations in a completely different way. I have seen men shot, stabbed, beaten, arrested, and go through deaths of children, parents, friends. And in my life, before coming in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I cannot remember any one occasion where I ever saw a man cry one tear under any circumstances, physical or emotional pain. On the other hand, although I've seen the women in many of those same situations, dead, shot, stabbed, losing people that they loved through death or other means, I saw a lot of them show pain and feel pain. It was quite obvious that they were feeling it. And I looked at those two different groups of people and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent my life trying to be what I thought a man was. And to me, a man was someone who cared about no one, who felt absolutely nothing, and if they did, never let anyone know it. Now, the problem that I had with that is that I was one of those people who seemed to have been born without any insulation whatsoever for my emotions. And so when I went out into the world to deal with other little kids, which was, I guess, around 5 or whatever, I'd go to school and these kids would tease me about being tall or being skinny or having curly red hair or my clothes being weird or whatever it was. And it would cut through me like knives going through my heart. And sometimes I would even start to cry. And I didn't even know these kids. It wasn't people I liked. It wasn't people I cared about. It was absolute strangers that were able to absolutely rip me to shreds. And so my earliest memories of myself are realizing that I was the thing that I hated the most. Because to me, the thing that I hated the most in anyone, most of all myself, were those things that I was to decide were weak. And nothing throughout my life was ever weaker than anyone who would cry. And so when I began to cry for people that I didn't even know or care about, I found out I was the thing that was the most disgusting in the entire world. I never liked anything about myself. I never liked my hair. I never liked where I lived. I never liked the family I was living in. I never liked the clothes that I had. I never liked the house that we were living in. Never liked the school that I was going to. And most of all, I never, for one instant, liked the way that I felt. Never. It was never peaceful. It was never calm. It always hurt. And throughout my life, I would hear people and they would talk about the fact that if you don't feel the bad, you'll never get to feel the good. And it sounded like a fair trade to me. I just didn't want to feel any of it. My first obsession in life was suicide. And from the time that I was 5 years old, I began to try and kill myself on a regular basis. And I don't believe that there were any days that went by before I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't try and kill myself. If I didn't do it myself, I put myself in a position where someone else would take my life, or I prayed to God that I would slowly be allowed to die, this God that I was stopping believing in. I just wanted out. I couldn't make it out there. Now, I've been to psychiatrists and I've been to psychologists and I don't remember how many times I've been. I really can't give you a diagnosis for why I felt that way about myself or why I tried to kill myself or why I did those things, because I felt about those people much like my friend Patty Hicks did. I always thought they should have to work for their money, and so I never told them anything. I never answered one question. I never gave them one bit of information to work with. You know, I just sat there silent. When I was growing up and my family would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I said a boy. It wasn't as easy to do back then as it is today. And it upset my family that I wanted to be a boy. And that was when they began to take me to the psychiatrists and the psychologists and the priests, because my family was fairly religious and in the Catholic religion. Somewhere along the line, I had to accept the fact that I was not going to be able to be a boy. And what that meant to me was only one alternative, the way I saw the world, and that was to be a tough broad. And I spent all my time before coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous trying to be what I thought a tough broad was. Now, I've learned the longer I'm sober and the more people that I have met that tough broads do vary geographically. Geographical standards do affect being a tough broad. In Venice, where I'm from, if you're a tough broad, you never wear shoes because it's a beach town. You run around in a gang, and I did. You do a lot of fighting, and I did. I've never won a fight in my life, but I never fought less than five people. And the thing that I learned after coming into the program is if you fight one person and you lose, someone may think you're not a very good fighter. If you always fight groups of five or more, no one expects you to win, and they think you must be pretty tough, or why would that whole group have to jump you? And that's how I live my life, getting my faith beat in a lot and walking around with it beat in. But some people actually thought I was tough. I never convinced the most important person, of course, and that was myself. Fortunately for me, the kind of person that I was and the way that I saw the world, I was introduced to drugs when I was 7 years old. I began to drink when I was 8. And by the time I was 9, I found a combination that I never altered in any way because I didn't need to. It was exactly what I needed. It was barbiturates or sleeping pills or downers, whatever you might know them as, and alcohol. And the combined effect of those got me exactly where I wanted to go. Complete oblivion. I wasn't a party girl. I've never had a social drink in my life. I don't have any cute, funny stories to tell you about the things I did when I was out there drinking. If you drank the way that I did and you mixed it with those kind of pills, you didn't do much either, you know. The last time I got beat up, it was by my own gang. They came by my house, and they said, if you come out of the house today, we're going to beat you up. And so I got up, and I immediately got dressed to go outside. Because I didn't want them to stand out there thinking I was sitting in the apartment afraid to come outside. I didn't want anyone to ever think I was afraid of anything. I did not recognize fear as an emotion. It was unacceptable. And so I went outside, and as I walked down the street, they started to follow me. And I thought, you know, I can either walk on the street or I can take the alley. And if I don't take the alley, they're going to think it's because I'm afraid to take the alley. And I didn't want anyone to think I was afraid to do anything. And so I took the alley and they jumped me and beat me up. Well, I laid in the alley and they were punching my face in and knocking my head against the asphalt. For whatever reason, that day, all they wanted was for me to cry. And I didn't cry. And I don't know how long they hit me. It seemed like a long time to me. Probably wasn't that long. When they got up and they left, I was standing there. I had a black eye. I had a swollen lip. I had blood running down my face. And if you'd asked me at that minute, I would have told you I won that fight. Because I didn't cry one tear. Not one. And at that time in my life, I could have been beat to death, I really believe, rather than shed one tear. And it seems so totally ridiculous to me tonight. Today. I mean, if somebody walked up to me right now and they said, look, June, I'll tell you what, I'm going to punch you in the face a few times so you can cry a few tears, I'd cry a few tears. I mean, it's really no big deal. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like, you know, Howard was talking. I mean, you know, yesterday, it's like, you know, who wants to get their ass kicked? It's just not that important. I've got other things to do, you know. I was brought to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous by my mother. It was not my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been to a number of them. My mother had been in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous from the time that I was 6 years old, with varying lengths of sobriety. And in case I leave her out there drinking, I want to let you know she is sober today, and she's been sober for 11 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. At this time, my mom brought me to a meeting, and she didn't bring me because I wanted help. She didn't bring me because I asked for help. She didn't bring me because I thought I needed help. She brought me because she thought that I would probably get her evicted from another apartment if she left me alone. I went to the meeting, and the miracle of this program began for me that day. It was a nighttime meeting, and it began because there was a man in that meeting that I admired more than anyone else in the world, and I did not admire very many people. And I admired this guy for a lot of reasons, some of which you may not identify with, but I'm going to share them with you anyway because they were my reasons. I admired him because he had tattoos, he'd been in prison, he carried a knife and had it with him at the meeting that night, he rode a motorcycle. And he was one of the most hostile and violent people I had ever known. And I looked at him and I thought, wow. I never thought people this great came to AA. I thought it was just for weak people like my mom, you know? I mean, if I had to tell you what I wanted out of life in one sentence when I came to this program, I wanted the ability to walk into rooms full of strangers and have everyone there back away from me in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that almost never happens. But that was the way I wanted to live my life. And Paul was the kind of guy, he was a drinking friend of my mother's, that I had seen walk into bars and walk into parties. And if he wanted to sit at your table, you'd let him. Because when Paul had been drinking, you didn't know what he was going to do if you didn't let him have what he wanted. And he had the ability to clear rooms and tables, and he had done everything I ever wanted to be able to do in life. And he was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it impressed me. It just made me wonder. I couldn't understand why someone that strong would be here. And I went out and got drunk the next night, and then I came back to meetings. And I went to lots and lots of meetings because Paul was going to lots and lots of meetings, and I didn't raise my hand because I wasn't an alcoholic. Even if I had been, I wouldn't have joined an organization that was allowing my mother to belong to it, you know. So I went to these meetings, and I talked to Paul, and in between the meetings, I explained to Paul that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I was too young to be an alcoholic, that I had my whole life ahead of me, that I was not alcoholic. I wasn't like my mother, who was really alcoholic. I was just not alcoholic. Now, I later found out that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people that they're not alcoholics. They already know that, you know. And Paul turned to me and he said, you know, June, I'm pretty new in this AA thing. And they've told me I cannot diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. I've seen the way that you drink, and I've seen the way that you use chemicals, and if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't talking about something some high school teacher made up. He was talking about facts. He was talking about things that had happened in his life. He was talking about things that had happened and were beginning to happen in mine. And I thought a little bit about what he said, but I did not want to be an alcoholic. I did not want to join AA. And in that two-week period of time, absolutely every alternative but AA was removed from my life. By the time I came to the program, at this particular point, the only person that I hated more than my mother was myself. And I hated my mother because I knew that she was responsible for everything that had ever gone wrong in my life. It had always been extremely convenient for me whenever I got caught stealing, fighting, breaking into people's homes, etc., to just say, well, you know, my mother is an alcoholic. I got out of everything by just telling a few minute details of my past, and I could get out of almost anything. And I started to find that everybody else was perfectly willing to blame my mother, and I was too. And so I hated this woman because she had caused everything that had ever gone wrong in my life. And at that particular point in time, because of the way that I felt about her and had for a long time, I was completely unable to control the rage that I felt towards this woman, and I used to attack her physically. Now, when my mother was drinking, she didn't really put up much of a defense. But now she was sober, and she no longer thought she had to be attacked on a regular basis. And she asked me to leave her home, and I did. The rest of my family had not spoken to me for a couple of years, and I was not allowed to call or come by under any circumstances, and I didn't even bother to try. I had been in and thrown out of 5 or maybe 6 foster homes by that time. None of them would take me back. I tried to get into some drug rehab and alcohol recovery homes that were in the L.A. area at that time. None of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. There was another program in the Los Angeles area at that time called Synanon, and I tried to get into Synanon, and they wouldn't take me either, and that was pretty bad because Synanon was desperate for membership at that time. And then as I was walking down that alley, all 5 of my last friends in the world, my gang members, beat me up. And so I was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 87 pounds. I had a black eye. I had a swollen lip. Had no shoes. Wouldn't have worn them if I'd had them. I had no family. I had no friends. I had no money. I had the clothes I had on. And I raised my hand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can see it was rather simple. It wasn't like, would you like to go to Hawaii or join AA? You know, I mean, it was a much easier decision than that. When I raised my hand in that meeting and in those few meetings, I know today that there were some people who did not know about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. In particular, the third tradition, the one that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And the reason I'm pretty sure they didn't know about that tradition is when I raised my hand, some of these people came up to me, not everyone, I don't want to mislead anybody, but some people came up to me after the meeting and they told me I was too young to be an alcoholic. and that they didn't want little kids sitting in their meetings while they talked about serious things. And they told me that they wanted me to leave, and if I came back, they would get together and throw me out. And I didn't know that they couldn't do that. I just figured AA didn't want me either, and that was fine with me, because I didn't want me either. And I had it for a long, long time. And I fell back on my number one answer. I went over to a friend of my mother's. I went into her bathroom, which is the first place I went at anyone's house I ever visited. I found the kind of pills that I needed, and I took enough to kill myself one more time. And before I passed out, I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the time I got to the meeting, I could not stand and I could not sit, so I laid in the meeting. I don't know about where you guys go to meetings here in Sacramento, but when I got sober in West LA, they almost never called on people to share who were laying in the meeting. But they called on me. And the next thing I remember was waking up in a hospital and a doctor explaining that he'd given me medication to make me throw up. And had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of because of the pills that I had taken. I don't know really why that was so different than all the other overdoses that I'd inflicted upon myself. I just know that it was. I know that because since that time, one day at a time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. That's how I personally define sobriety. I do that one day at a time. If I continue to do that the 13th of July of this year, I'll celebrate 17 continuous years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think one of the most important things I can tell you, especially if you're new or visiting, is that I never planned on staying 17 years. And when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, if there had been a yes-no box for whether I wanted to live for 17 more years, there's absolutely no question as to which box I would have checked. I did not ever, in my wildest dreams, want to go on living for another 17 years. What drove me through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous was the way that I felt about myself. I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't hate myself anymore. I hated myself with every fiber of my being, and I couldn't do it anymore. And I did not stay in Alcoholics Anonymous because I was afraid of going out on the streets and dying. I've never thought I'd be that lucky. Never. As tough as the times have gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous, it has not been the fear of dying that had kept me in. It's been the fear of living the way that I was living, the way some of you lived for 20 or 30 years. I couldn't do it. I could not make it out there. Now, when I came in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, it sometimes sounds like we get sober, we take a 30-day chip, and we suddenly feel really good about ourselves and our lives, and everything is wonderful. And that has not been my story. I came into this program, and when alcohol and drugs were removed from me, I hated myself as much as I ever had. I did not take baths or showers after I got sober for a long time. I did not wear makeup for a long time. There was absolutely no way I was going to stand in front of a mirror and look at me. And I'm talking about sober. Because in sobriety, I had all the same feelings that I had always had about myself. And I just couldn't stand it. I couldn't believe how much I hated myself. Every time I saw myself in a mirror, I felt like throwing up. And I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I listened to people share. And they shared about the fact that they, too, had lost all of their self-worth or their self-esteem through a variety of different ways. And that somewhere along the line, as they got sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and they did the things that were asked of them, that they were able to look themselves in the eye in a mirror, that they were able to look out there on the street at God's kids right in the eye, and feel just as good, not better than, not less than, just like one of God's kids. And I sat there and I thought, that'll never happen for me. But maybe if I go to lots and lots of meetings, maybe if I really try hard, maybe someday when I look in a mirror, I won't feel like throwing up. And that was enough hope to keep me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't happy about it. I am extremely grateful today for the people who were here when I got here. It's just unbelievable the amount of tolerance that those people showed me. It's far more than I think I even have today. But I came into this program with a bad attitude. I don't want you to think I suddenly developed a bad attitude when I got here. I simply came here with the only attitude I had ever had, and it was just bad. I did not like women. I didn't like any women. I didn't like me. I didn't like my mother. I figured any other women around here had to be like one of the two of us, and I didn't like them. I wasn't going to kiss them. I wasn't going to hug them, and I didn't want to listen to them speak, which is something that always makes me feel better because I know there are never as many people listening to me as it looks like, you know. Now, as far as the men were concerned, the only men I had ever known in my life were alcoholic men who beat up women, and they scared me, and I didn't want anything to do with them either. Now, I had a problem because in July of 1972, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, all we had were men and women, and I didn't like any of them. I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to 21 meetings a week most of my first 2 years. I didn't do that because I wanted to get a gold star in AA. They weren't really giving them out, as I recall. It was simply I had no place else to go. There wasn't any place else for me to hang out. You know, I just needed to be there, and I just went from one meeting to another. Now, I had a very limited vocabulary when I came to the program. It consisted almost solely of profanity. There were a few exceptions, the and mother. And there were a number of people in AA who were extremely offended by that type of language, and so I used it more when they were around. I didn't wear shoes most of the first 2 years that I was sober. It wasn't like I took them off to go to the meeting. I just didn't wear them. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day, and I lit all of them myself. Occasionally, someone would hold a match, and I let them hold it. As long as they liked, but they never lit my cigarette with it. And after I'd been sober a few weeks, I took up smoking cigars and then a pipe. I also had a jacket that I wore to meetings that on the back said, do unto others and then split. And I wore motorcycle chains on my wrists and my ankles. Now, what I want to tell you is that if you choose to dress that way, smoke that way, and talk the way that I did, you too can sit in a meeting, maybe not quite this big, but fairly large, and have an entire row all to yourself. Because there were plenty of people who did not want anything to do with me, and I don't blame them. They made me the greeter at the Tuesday night Westwood meeting. And I would stand there, barefoot, my motorcycle jacket and chains and cigar, welcoming the newcomer as they came to AA. Sometimes as they'd walk by, I'd hear their sponsor say, you see, if you keep drinking, you can end up like that. When I got sober, people were guessing my age, and some of them were guessing me at 37, and I was 13 at the time. I had a lot of people come up to me after meetings, and they explained to me that they had spilled more than I had drank. And I, of course, explained to them that if they hadn't spilled that much, they probably would have gotten sober younger. I'm very grateful to the people who tolerated me as I was. Now, I went to these 21 meetings a week. I've already told you how I felt about women. And at these meetings, it seemed as though at 18 of these meetings every week, a woman named Gail Wilson talked. I thought to myself, my keen alcoholic mind, perhaps if I ask this woman to be my sponsor, I can find out where she's speaking, and then I won't have to go hear her all the time. So that was how I got a woman for a sponsor. Now, there's a few people here who knew Gail, and it's hard for me to explain. Gail and I were very different. Gail wore pink in public. I was over 10 years sober before anything pink even entered my home. Gail did not use the same language that I did, and she didn't know what some of the words I was using meant. And I would go to the Brentwood meeting, and I would see Gail. And Gail would say, look, June, don't sit next to me at the meeting. I can't take the cigar smoke. And then she'd say, and please, don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor. And that was fine with me, because I didn't want anyone to know I was hanging out with someone lame like Gail, you know. And so we would meet after meetings secretly and talk about AA. I have a seventh grade education. Excuse me. I dropped out of school, and I did not go back. I just went to lots and lots of meetings. And I got the kind of job that I could get with a seventh grade education. And it was a great job for me because it allowed me the flexibility to go to 21 meetings a week. Now, when I had been sober a few years, I think it was, as I look back on it, I got an opportunity to go to a business college and be a secretary. If there's anything in my life I never wanted to be, it was a secretary. Very few tough broads grow up to be secretaries. But I went. And I started these classes. I did okay in most of the stuff. I started out typing 17 words a minute with 9 errors. I typed one day at a time for 14 months. And at the end of that time, I was typing 37 words a minute with 19 errors. And they told me I wasn't going to make it as a secretary. I thought I could have told them that 14 months ago. Anyway, but they told me I could probably get an office job, but I'd have to get an equivalent to a high school diploma. And I went out and I took this test that you have to take to get a high school diploma. It's all about the subjects that you'd learn about in high school if I'd went. And I did okay on the first 4 parts, and the 5th part was math. And I can, at this point, I can add and subtract and multiply and divide if you give me enough time. That's to this day. And this test began with algebra. And then it started to do things that I couldn't even pronounce, let alone do. Like one of the things was they had a rectangle, then they draw a line across the middle, and they'd say how many feet are in one of those triangles. So I sat there and drew little pictures of feet in there. I have no more idea than today how the hell you're supposed to figure that out. But I knew I was in trouble, and all the answers on the test were A, B, C, or D, and I was at the bargain stage of my sobriety. So I turned to my higher power, and I said, look, God, I'll tell you what I'm going to do here. I'm going to go through this test, and I'm going to pick lots of A's, you know, for AA. And I hope you know your math. And I hate to be the one to tell you this, but God's as bad at math as he is at typing. Anyway, I passed the test, and I had to go out and start looking for a job. Now, I'm going to tell you a little story about the way that I felt about myself. I was 11 months sober. There was the San Francisco International Young People's Convention in 1973, and a bunch of people from the Monday Night Venice group, my home group, got together and went. We got about 12 people in a car for 4. And we headed out. Now, I have grown up in Venice pretty much. I'd run away once and made it to Culver City, which is about 6 miles east. And that was about as far as I'd ever been. And we went to San Francisco, which is about 400 miles. And we pulled up at this hotel, which was like no hotel I had ever seen. I mean, my mom being an alcoholic, we lived in a lot of hotels and motels. They did not look like this. This place was called the St. Francis Hotel. And I've never been there. I suppose a lot of you have because it's close. You know, I had never been there before. I've never been back, so I only remember the way I saw it in 1973. But we pulled up at this place, and there were other people that were going to park the car. We never had a car, and I had never seen other people parking people's car. I couldn't believe it. And then I looked inside, and there were like all these red velvet drapes and this beautiful thick carpet, and there were men wearing suits in there, and there were women wearing long dresses, and it was daytime, for Christ's sakes, you know? And I wasn't even wearing shoes yet. And I said to my friends, I'm not going in there. And they said, oh yeah, this is where the convention is. And I said, I'm not going in there. People like me don't go in places like that. And they said, no, this is where the convention is. And it took them a couple of hours, and they convinced me to go into the hotel. As far as I thought, I snuck into the hotel. I went into the room. It's the only convention of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've ever been to then or since. I've probably been to hundreds of them now. And I never went to one meeting. I just stayed in the room, terrified that someone was going to find me out and come up to me and say, excuse me, this is a nice place. This is for good people. You're from Venice, right? You're going to have to leave. I mean, you know, and I didn't want to embarrass myself or my friends. And that's sort of how I felt about myself. Now, these feelings I know today that I had, I continued to do a lot of things to make sure that they didn't change. I didn't get rid of my old ideas, and I'm going to try and talk about that in a little bit, what helped me with that. But anyway, I went ahead, and at this point I started to look for a job, and you can see that I was not, you know, over brimming with self-confidence on the job front. But some people in Alcoholics Anonymous told me that if you're going to look for an office job, you got to dress a certain way, and they gave me some clothes, and we went to Salvation Army, we bought me some other clothes, and we put these clothes on. It was like Halloween, with the little Venice Bride in the citizen costume. You know, I it was very weird, and I went out there, and I did a lot of job interviews, and I got a job. It was a very square job. I knew Gail would love it. And I went to work. I worked really hard one day at a time for 7 days, and they called me in the office. And I thought they were going to give me a raise. And they fired me. And she said, "I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go. You don't have enough experience." And she said, "And not only that, you don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever." Now, I didn't know what that meant, but I knew I was being insulted. And I went downstairs and I went across the street and I called the LA Central office and I said, "This is June G. I'm sober and I've just been fired. What are you going to do about that?" And they just laughed. I had been sober, I'm sure, a couple of years at that time. I had never heard of anyone sober in AA being fired. And I did not think we would allow that sort of thing to happen. You know, I thought we'd kick it or something. And I remember I went home and I called Bob. And I said, "You know, I never got fired before I came to AA." And he reminded me I'd never had a job. And that kind of intuition that people have that have been around the program for a while is ever so helpful. That hadn't occurred to me. I got an opportunity to go on to school, and I got a job on campus. And I went to school one day at a time. And it was the first thing other than staying sober that I was able to do one day at a time. I couldn't do a job one day at a time very well. I just couldn't make it there all the time. You know, I tried. I'd go to bed at night very, very late, and I'd say, "Now look, God, I got to be at work at 8. And if it's your will, make sure I'm up by 7 or I won't make it." And invariably, it would not be God's will for me to get up until 9 or 10. And I lost a lot of jobs that way. But for some reason, by the time I started school, I was able to show up. And showing up, like Shauna talked about, has had a lot to do with my life changing. I remember hearing people say when I was new that you can't think your way into right living. You have to live your way into right thinking. And that has been true for me. I have never yet sat in a room and thought things through and come out feeling better. I have been told that I've never had a problem yet that has been as bad as my solution for it. And so for me, a lot of the time, it has to do with showing up and getting out of my mind and out of my head and just being there where I say I'm going to be. The first thing I ever felt good about myself in my entire life was I was somewhere between 2 and 5 years sober, and it somehow occurred to me that I wasn't that bad a member of AA. And that was the closest thing to a compliment I ever remember thinking about myself. And the reason for that was that if I was asked to do something in AA, I did it. And if I told you I would be there, I was. And I was as close to on time as I could be. Now, the rest of my life was a complete disaster as far as any sense of responsibility or dependability or anything else. But if I made an AA commitment, I showed up, unless I was in a hospital or had been, you know, or something had happened. And that is how I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was years later the first thing that was to give me some kind of a good feeling about myself that I'd ever had. Anyway, I went ahead and I finished school. They called me in the office, and they told me that I completed all the requirements for what they called an AA degree, which I thought was a nice name for a college degree. When I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not read anymore. I had been able to read before, but I couldn't read because I couldn't concentrate on more than one sentence. I'd read from the beginning to the end, and then I couldn't remember the beginning, and I'd go back and I'd read it over and over and over, and I had the same problem with the big book for many, many months, maybe even years, and I just couldn't hold that many words in. And the reason I had started to take a class at school was I'd taken this dummy English class to see if maybe I could learn to read again. And when I graduated from that school, there were some people from my family there, and Bob was there, and Gail was there, and they announced that I was graduating third in my class out of 485 students. And and all I did was I showed up. I don't think that's possible for someone like me had I not found Alcoholics Anonymous. It could not happen for me, for someone like me. I went ahead and I went on to university, a rival one of Shauna's, and I finished a few years later. And I had this dream, and I went ahead and I did the footwork for this dream. I don't know when I had the dream. I can't remember if I had it before I got sober or after or what. I don't remember. But I did the footwork, and I got a telegram. It's been over 8 years ago now, telling me that I'd been chosen as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. Now, I want to assure you, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had always planned on spending a lot of time in court. But never on that side of the table. And I started law school 8 years ago. And today I practice law. And I have a job that I love very, very much and where I feel I'm able to be of service. And it's absolutely incredible to me that these things could happen to someone like me from where I came from. I want to jump around a little bit and tell you a few things. I think one of the big areas that we always seem to talk about a lot and seems pretty important is relationships. And I want to talk about it a little bit. When I got sober, I was single, and I suppose that's good if you're 13, but I didn't think so. Because I knew that anyone who was married had never had any problems. Because Mom was never married, and I knew if she'd been married, we would have all been happy. And so I hated people who were married in AA, or out. I hated all people who were married. I hated anyone who had a car, because we didn't have a car. And I hated a lot of people. Anyway, I think if you come into the program and you're single, you're bound to eventually have to date. And I'm very sorry to tell you that, because I always hated dating. I'd much rather fall in love, and usually did. I'm exactly the kind of person that woman was talking about last night, about meeting someone at the coffee pot and falling in love. I've done that a number of times, and then the next night if they come to a meeting with another woman, I think they're being unfaithful, you know. And if you hang around AA and you begin to date, you're probably going to have an AA date. I don't know if you have those here in Sacramento. They're very popular in West LA. It's where a guy asks you out and takes you to a meeting. Where else would you go, you know? And after the meeting, you go to coffee and you talk about the meeting. And by the time he takes you home, you don't know whether to kiss him goodnight or say the Lord's Prayer. I remember one of those dates, I was at the coffee stage of my date. And this guy said, you know, I really like you. And I said, well, thanks. He said, but I like your girlfriend at the next table better. Do you mind if I sit with her? I said, why, no, not at all. Of course, I'm tough. And he did, and I left, and I went home and thought things through. And, I got up in the morning, and I had come up with the only solution to this type of life. Then I went down, and I tried to join the United States Air Force. I figured, screw them, you know. And the Air Force wouldn't take me, and then I called Bob. And that's what I recommend. If the Air Force won't take you, then you might want to think about calling a sponsor or someone, you know. At somewhere in this period of time, I got emotionally involved. Well, I mean, I got emotionally involved thousands of times, but I mean, they did too. And I think we went out for, oh, I don't know, it wasn't quite 30 days, I'm sure. But we had been going out together for over 2.5 years without ever going out for 30 days straight. And this guy, I sort of didn't really need to work on a higher power when I had a boyfriend, because I really thought people should either have a higher power or a boyfriend. And I didn't think it was fair if you had a relationship for you to keep God busy, because I had a lot of things to talk to him about. But when I had a relationship, I could, you know, he was freer. So anyway, when this relationship broke up, I felt pain like I had never felt pain before. And I absolutely could not believe it. And I sat there and I thought things through. And I decided I was going to have to kill myself. And right then there was a knock on the door. And this guy from AA knocked on the door, and I opened the door, and he said, hi. He said, how you doing? And I said, oh, fine. And he said, well, you know, you're ready to go, aren't you? And I said, go where? And he said, well, you know, I told you that we were going to go over to this Santa Monica College and, or high school or something, you know, and talk to these kids a little bit about alcoholism and AA. And you said you'd come with me. Central office was sending this. And I said, look, to the experience, strength, and hope I do not have, all right? I was just going to go in the bathroom and kill myself. And he said, oh, well, have you had dinner? And I said, no. He said, well, I'll tell you what, let's go, we'll have dinner. Then we'll go to the school. He said, I'll just talk, you don't have to say anything, and then I'll bring you home and you can kill yourself. And I said, okay. So we left and we went out to dinner, but I didn't talk to him because I was deep in thought. And I wouldn't let him play the radio because I was concentrating on the pain that I was in. And if you begin to talk to someone or listen to something, you might begin to feel better, and you don't want that. So I was very deep in thought, and I was, in order to feel the maximum amount of pain, you have to concentrate not only on the pain that you are in, but on knowing that there will never be anyone else ever again. Because if you don't concentrate on that, you'll miss some of the pain that you can experience. So I was deep in concentration. And we got to this school, and we were wandering along. I was deep in thought. And this woman I'd never met before walked up to me, and he said, excuse me, do you know where room 231 is? And I said, no. And she said, would you help me find it? I thought, all right. So we wandered around the school. I got her lost. And she started talking. So what kind of class are you taking? And I said, well, I'm not really taking a class. She said, well, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I came with some people, and we were going to talk a little bit about, you know, alcoholism. She said, really? For it or against it? I said, well, I guess you'd say against it. I never really heard of any talk for alcoholism, you know. And she said, really? She said, I'm on the wagon. And I said, well, that's wonderful. I've known a lot of people on the wagon that usually fall off. I said, but that's great if it works for you, you know. She said, well, why would you give that kind of talk? And I said, because I'm an alcoholic, and I stay sober one day at a time through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to go to a meeting sometime? And she said, yes. And we changed phone numbers. We made arrangements to go to a meeting the next night. Obviously, I couldn't go home and kill myself. She'd think AA didn't work. And I took Kay to lots and lots of meetings. And Kay did not get sober at that time, but I stayed sober. I learned about what it talks about in the book when it says working with others. And in the very first paragraph there, it says, when all else fails, try working with another alcoholic. And that saved my life. And I have as much to do with my being sober now and with Kay being an alcoholic as she has to do with my still being here. And Kay in August of last year celebrated 13 continuous years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went ahead and, as far as, you know, dating, I went on and on, but I look back and I can see that, I heard a woman sharing some different, ideas that had meant a lot to me. This is the way that I went about having a relationship, just to give you some indication of the way that I was. You see, I did not believe that you should feel anything, care about anyone, or ever let them know it if you did. Alright, those were my values. That was what was important. Now, what I was waiting for was I was waiting to meet a man who would come up to me and say, I love you, I need you, I care about you. And then I would say, me too. The funny thing is that when you go out with people and you continuously say, I don't need you, I don't care about you, it doesn't matter to me whether you live or die, I found that they rarely say, I love you, I need you, I care about you. So I was having some trouble. Anyway, I started to go out with this guy when I was around 7 years sober, and he left me for a younger woman. And it was absolutely devastating, not because he left me for a younger woman. What was devastating was that he knew that I liked him. And I had never really made that clear to anyone before. I went to a convention of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a huge one in Southern California. There were 7,000 people there. I was asked to read something. I think it was the promises or a vision for you. I started to read and I began to cry. And I wanted to die because I didn't know if he was there. I wanted to die that this man could know that I cared so much about anyone that I would cry in public. And I went through a period of time at 7 years sober, which was, oh, I don't know, sometimes people refer to it as a second surrender, or I don't know. But at 7 years sober, I realized that for me, I had a major decision to make. I had to either give up my old ideas and begin to live the way of life that was being offered to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, or I had to go back out there on the street. Because at that point in my life, my values were still such that I did not want anyone to know if I cared about them. I never wanted anyone to see me vulnerable. I never wanted to cry. And I never wanted to let anyone know that I was weak. Ever. And at that point in time, I realized that 7 years sober, I couldn't control it any longer. I was going to have feelings. I was going to get embarrassed. I was going to cry because I was happy or sad, both. You know, I was going to get my feelings hurt. All of these things. The only way I was ever able to not care for things to not matter was to use and be under the influence. And that was the only way I'd ever been able to do it. And if I was going to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, then I was going to have to go ahead and be vulnerable and to be different than I had ever wanted to be and to be the thing that I was sure I would hate even more than the person I hated so much then. And it wasn't as easy a decision as it might seem. But I knew at that point in time that I did not want to go back out there and live that way. And at that point in time, I think, is when I made a commitment to trying to get rid of my old ideas and to stop trying to be tough. And since that time, I can look back and I can see my life is, I'm not surrounded by tough people anymore. There aren't any people in my life that I don't know love me. There aren't any people in my life that make me think they don't care whether I live or die or whether I'm happy or sad. The people that are in my life, they let me know that they care about me, and I try to do the same. It's a very different way of life than I ever wanted. And it's been fascinating to me. I've learned about what Gail would explain to me about the difference between being tough and being strong. I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous to be strong. I am stronger than I have ever been. It's what I meant by being tough. It doesn't mean I can kick the shit out of anybody in this room. That's what I thought it meant. It means that I have something inside that I never had. See, when I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't wear pink because I was afraid of what you thought it meant if I wore pink. See, today I can wear pink if I want, and I can wear black leather if I want. And it doesn't change who I am on the inside. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me what I need to do to change me on the inside. And so much of changing me on the inside that has come from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has had very little to do with what I've done on the outside. When I look in the mirror today, I feel like I've had plastic surgery. I mean major plastic surgery. Because it is not the same face that I have looked back at all my life. I'm not the same person that I used to be. And when I used to do, you know, Bob was talking last night about going and looking in mirrors and saying things to himself. I've always done that too, and I used to do it whenever a relationship would end. I would go and I would look in a mirror and I would say, look at you. Look at you. You wonder why they left? You should be lucky they stayed that long. Why would anybody want to stay with you? And that was the way I always talked about myself or saw myself. And when I went through that period of time where I gave up my old ideas and realized through a number of different events, I was facing felony charges, misdemeanor charges, my whole life was in ruins, and I was 7 years sober, and I realized I did not want to live the old way anymore. And I gave up and decided to try the way that we had in Alcoholics Anonymous. At that point in time, I went on, and not too long after that, I got involved in a relationship. And we had a lot of fun, and it didn't last. And when that guy left, I went back to my mirror like I always do, and I stood there, and I was all ready to say all the same things, and I couldn't do it. Because I'm not that person anymore. He lost something too. Doesn't mean we were supposed to get together. It doesn't mean we were supposed to spend the rest of our lives together. But I thought, you know, there's something here, and he's losing out on being with me. And I never thought that those kind of things could happen for me. I was at the Palm Springs Roundup at a banquet one night, and I was a few years sober, 5, 7, I don't know. I was standing there, and I was all dressed up like everybody else was, and I was comparing myself to everyone else there like I always do still. And I was standing there wearing this long, full-length brown dress. I was looking around, I go, look, June, look at that black dress over there. Don't you wish you were wearing that black dress? And I thought, nope. But what do you mean, nope, I talked to myself. What do you mean, nope? It's like, it's a nice dress, but I like this brown dress. I thought, you are kidding. Nope, I like the brown dress. So, all right, what about the green dress? I mean, green is your favorite color. Don't you wish you were wearing that dress? I'm like, nope, I'm really glad I'm wearing this brown dress. I'm like, you're kidding. No? I thought, you know what? I talked to myself some more. I said, I'm really glad I have curly red hair and I am tall and skinny. Like, you're kidding. No. Like, don't you want to be blonde or stacked or anything? I said, no. I just want to look just like me. And then something far more significant than any of that all put together. For the very first time in my life, I wanted to feel like me. I wanted to be living my life. I didn't want to be going out with who you were going out with. I didn't wish I had your parents. I didn't wish I had your car. I didn't wish I lived in that house. I didn't wish I was wearing your dress. I didn't wish my hair looked like your hair and my makeup looked like that. And I wish I'd worn that color lipstick. Everything at that instant was perfect. I was perfect, just like I was. And I'm not, you know, believe me, at that point in time, things were not great. You know what I mean? Whether I'd pay the rent every month was a big deal. Putting a dollar in the basket at an AA meeting was a virtual impossibility for me. I mean, we were questioning whether I could eat. And yet everything was perfect right then. And I couldn't believe it. And I still can't. And I'm not going to tell you that every moment since that time has been like that. That's not true. There's days I'd rather be blonde and fat. You know, I mean, plenty of them. But that for any instant in time, I could want to be who I am. And most of the instants now I do. I want my life. It's the best life I've ever had. I'm delighted that I'm able to participate in it. You know. And it's nothing like what I would have planned or what I would have wanted. I just got married 3 months ago. And I married a man who has never been to prison and has no tattoos. I didn't even want to go out with him. I didn't know what we'd talk about, you know? And when the first couple of months that we were dating, he came home and he had 2 tickets to Chicago, which is where he's from. He has a pretty large family. Because he wanted to take me home to introduce me to the people that meant the most in his life. Because he was so proud of me. And he was proud of what Alcoholics Anonymous had made possible in my life. Of what it has made me be able to be. And we went back there and we spent time, and I'm very close with his family. And at my wedding, all of my family was there. And I had 2 great uncles who had never met me, who came from Canada to represent my grandparents. And I want to guarantee you that in 1972, I couldn't get anyone in my family to drive from Venice to Culver City to be with me. I'm going to tell you one other story, and then I'm going to sit down. About 2 years ago, something like that, I was walking down the street in Culver City on my way to a pet store, and I saw a man. And he saw me, and we looked at each other in the eye. And I knew that it was Paul. Paul, that guy that had so much to do with my staying in AA. Paul, the guy who made that impression on me. And I looked him in the eye and we stood there and we talked a few seconds. We just couldn't believe it. It had been 14 years since we'd seen each other pretty much. And Paul was on his way to the pet store with Petey, his little bird. Because Petey's the only friend Paul has. Paul's family won't talk to him. His daughter sends back the cards. She writes on the seat. She doesn't want anything to do with him anymore. And Paul was telling me that the night before, Petey had gotten out of the hotel room because his wings were long and had flown away. And Paul said he was going to die because all he has in the world is Petey. And he managed to get Petey and take him to the pet store so he could get his wings clipped. And I said, let's go, you know, sit down across the street. There's a little cafe and we'll talk a little bit. And we went across the street to talk. Paul, I ordered coffee or decaf or whatever, and Paul ordered a beer. Probably the only person that I've ever known was an alcoholic that I bought a drink for, or believed was an alcoholic and bought a drink for. And we sat there and we talked. And Paul asked me what was going on and what I was doing. And I told him, I'm a lawyer, and I work downtown LA. And he asked if he could see one of my business cards.
and I handed him a card. And he looked at me, and he had tears in his eyes, and so did I. He said, "Oh, my God." He said, "I just can't believe it." I said, "I know, it's incredible." And he said, "I must have taught you really well." And I said, "Yes, you did." And it's important for me to remember that sometimes the people who teach me the best don't even get the lesson themselves. But that doesn't mean that it's not important that we go on teaching it. There are so many people in my life that I love, some who've gone on and passed on, and died sober. Two women that I was extremely close with who died before they were basically 50 years old to cancer. And I've been through those kinds of experiences. But in sobriety and in the last month, years actually, I don't think about dying. I don't think about killing myself anymore. I've realized for me that killing myself is just another way of my saying, "Do it my way, God, or I'll just kill myself." And what I do is I just show up and I ask God to show me how I can be of service, and then I get out there and I try to do it. And I've learned it here, and it's the best life I've ever had. Thanks for inviting me.